celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you listening. Appreciate you tuning in. In this first hour of the show, we will be talking about automotive safety and trying to look at two fairly broad categories. In one category, we have things that apply to the vehicle itself that may or may not make it safe, and how to think about that, particularly if you're thinking about going out and buying a new vehicle for yourself, your family. The other broad category has to do with drivers, the people who operate the vehicles, and things that we may do or not do that indeed makes us less safe as drivers. Our guests for this first hour is Russ Rader. He is the Media Relations Director for the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. It is an independent, nonprofit highway safety research group that is funded by the auto insurers. They do research on a number of things, a wide range of vehicle and driver behavior issues. They also conduct crash tests to rate the crash worthiness of new vehicles. We certainly would be open to questions and people who are listening, whatever questions you might have, as long as it falls into one of these categories. I'm sure that our guest will see if he can give you an answer. And of course, we'll ask some basic questions too. So whatever's on your mind, you could certainly join us by calling the number here for Champaign-Urbana listeners, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Again, locally, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Rader, hello.
Yes, good morning.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
Let me just start out with one topic. The thing that perhaps caught our eye and started us to think generally about the subject and to look for someone to talk with, and that has to do with the increasing horsepower of cars. And we came across this article, and here are some statistics that are cited in the article, and I'm assuming that this is correct. If you go back to 1975, and this was a time when people were concerned about fuel prices and so forth. New cars in 1975 averaged 136 horsepower, and that went down to 99 in 1982, and that's maybe that would be at a level where you'd say that's really almost not enough.
Yeah.
But apparently in the last two decades, average horsepower has been climbing, and in 2004, the typical new car had 184. And the thing that perhaps got our attention and certainly caught the attention of the author of this particular article was that at the recent North American International Automotive Show, there were 18 models on display there that had 500 horses or more, which struck him perhaps as being excessive. So I guess the bottom line question is horsepower. Is there a certain point at which horsepower becomes, do you think, a safety issue?
Well, what we're seeing is, I think, sort of a culture of speed in the United States. It is a fact that manufacturers, for a time, because of government pressure and market forces, they were putting a great deal of their investment dollars in technology into improving fuel economy. But as that government and market pressure receded, the technological dollars and research dollars shifted to increasing horsepower instead. And so we are seeing a steady increase in horsepower. In fact, we did a report last year that showed that the average horsepower of vehicles on the market today now exceeds the average horsepower during the muscle car era of the 1960s. Hmm. So you have a couple of different things going on. You have this horsepower race that seems to be never-ending. You have a culture that seems to accept speed as not being a big problem, and it is a safety issue because a third of all fatal crashes have speed as a factor. So it's a problem out on our highways that is getting worse.
Well, that that certainly is the issue relating to the horsepower of the car, because what we really are talking about is the capacity for the car to go fast and also to accelerate very fast when you have a big engine like that with a lot of horses.
And we have improved vehicles so that, 25 years ago, if you took a vehicle out on the highway and went 85 miles an hour, you'd feel the chassis rattling underneath you. And today, vehicles are so well built that they can handle those speeds with no problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess here maybe is an opportunity to hook up the hardware issue with the software. In a sense, the car and its capacity to perform and the ability of the average driver to be able to handle that kind of performance. I mean, do you think that we are putting too much power into the hands of the average driver?
Well, who needs 300, 400, and 500 horsepower? I guess that's the question. I mean, what I said earlier, that vehicles can handle 85 miles per hour no problem, it is a problem because it increases the likelihood of a crash. It reduces the amount of time that you have to react if there's a problem in the roadway ahead of you, and it increases the severity of the crash. Vehicle horsepower is a factor in all this, and the manufacturers are touting speed and horsepower like they never have before in their advertising. Speed, our attitude towards speed today is about like what our attitude toward drinking and driving was 30 years ago. People who were around 30 years ago will tell you that it wasn't seen as a big deal. People who went out and drank and then drove home, it was part of the culture, and nobody thought it was a major problem. But then we had advocacy groups come on the scene who talked about the victims of these terrible crashes, and attitudes changed. And that's about where we are with speeding. People don't think going 85 miles an hour on the highway is that big of a problem because everybody does it. But it is a big safety problem. People think it won't happen to me. I won't be in a crash.
Well, I'm sure there are people who are listening who are to us who are old enough to remember when, back in the mid-70s, there was a national speed limit, 55.
Right.
And that over time that has changed so that we have some places now around the country where it's common that the speed limit is now 65, and there are places where it's actually 70 and 75.
That's a very good point, because another factor in all of this is that states have been raising their speed limits. And a common myth is that, well, if people are going 75 in a 65 mile per hour zone, why don't we just raise the speed limit up to 75 to accommodate those people? Our roads can handle it. Our cars can handle it. Let's just make it 75. But what happens when you do that is you just shift the people who are going at excessively high speeds into an even higher bracket. The people who are going 75 in the 65 zone are now going 85 in the 75 zone. Instead of just accommodating the people who want to go 75, you're simply increasing the average speed on that roadway to even higher levels.
Well, that makes it sound as if what is happening is what I would have suspected, and that is that generally, no matter what the speed limit is, that people are averaging about 10 miles over it. Is that true?
That is correct. People will generally drive at the speed at which they think they are unlikely to get a ticket. People will, if they perceive that about 5 to 10 miles an hour over the limit that they can get by with that, that's the speed at which they will drive. And so when you increase the speed limit, you just shift those speeds another 10 miles an hour, 5 or 10 miles an hour higher. We did a survey around the country last year looking at average speeds in major metro areas and on rural interstates around the country, and we recorded the highest average speeds we have ever recorded in 15 years of doing these surveys. So as speed limits have gone up, as vehicles have become more capable, we see ever-increasing speeds where 10 or 15 years ago, it was rare to clock a vehicle at 85 miles per hour on interstates in, say, New Mexico or Atlanta. Now it is commonplace.
Has the insurance industry lobbied state governments to, or the federal government, to reduce speed limits?
They have. We are not a research organization, not a lobbying organization. But lobbying organizations for the insurance industry have spoken out about this speed creep that's going on around the country. But until we have a change in attitudes, there doesn't seem to be the political will to reduce speed limits. The political momentum is to increase speed limits.
Well, given, and this again is a little bit outside of your mandate, but given the fact that in this country, generally speaking, we seem to have this attitude that says, or at least a lot of people think that less regulation is better, and that, for example, to the issue of horsepower on cars, I don't think there would be a lot of sympathy to for passing a law that says we're going to limit the horsepower to a particular level. If people want to go out and buy a car that's got 500 horses, we're going to say to them, fine, you can do that. And then that seems that perhaps the only opportunity is if you're concerned about that, is to do some kind of public education that says, look, folks, maybe that might seem cool, but it's potentially dangerous and you really don't need that. The average driver certainly doesn't need that. And why don't you consider something more like this? And how does the industry approach an issue like that?
Well, I mean, one of the things that seems to be happening with the automakers is that they want to one-up each other on horsepower. I'm not really sure that there's a market out there for the horsepower that they're promoting. I mean, is there a very large market for a 400-horsepower vehicle when most of us are in our commutes, our daily commutes to work, are sitting in traffic a lot of the time? I mean, I just don't know who's buying these vehicles. It seems to me that's sort of a niche market, but what it does is it sort of feeds into this this culture of speed that I was talking about before, where it just seems okay, regardless of how many horsepower your vehicle has, to go very fast.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Russ Rader, and just to introduce him again, and we have a caller we'll get to. He's Media Relations Director for the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. This is an independent nonprofit research group that is funded by the auto insurers, where they do research into a lot of different issues, including driver behavior and also crash worthiness of vehicles. And if you have questions about this whole issue of auto safety, you can certainly call, and I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here in Indiana on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I guess the first time I heard Insurance Institute, I started thinking other things than dealing with speed. So I'm interested in transparency for the first question. I guess just to put it straightforward, do you give out information to the insurance agency about all the different models, let's say Ford, Chevrolet, Mercedes, things like that, rate them, show how you handicap that rating to get the position they are on, the safest car for turning corners or whatever you do? And secondly, if I remember correctly, this is going back to that one state, I don't know if it was Montana, anyway, it was out there, the razor speed limit, like up to 75 or something. And anecdotally, I heard on, at least on public radio, that the accidents increased proportionally or even more than proportionally, and the deaths increased quite a bit too, and that somewhere along the line they dropped back on their speed limit. And I was wondering if, if you knew about that and what the general situation is on states that have increase their speed limits and whether or not the union entails increase in accidents and deaths. Thank you.
Yeah, those are both good questions. In terms of the insurance rates, we are a research organization, and we do not get involved in how insurers set insurance rates. They do that using a variety of different methods and looking at the real-world crash experience of the particular vehicle that you drive, your age, a whole bunch of different things go into that, but that's not something that we are involved in. Secondly, on the issue of speed, there is a great deal of evidence that shows that when states raise speed limits, the death rates go up. And there was just a study done recently looking at the states that had raised their speed limits over the last 5 to 10 years. I don't know specifically what the situation is in Montana. I was just going to look here on our website to see what the speed limit laws currently are in Montana. I don't know that they had dropped back their speed limits there, but I could be wrong about that. It looks like they had changed their speed limits in 1999, and that probably means that they increased them. The speed limits on the rural interstates in Montana are 75, and the urban interstates are 65. But there is clear evidence that when states do raise their speed limits, there's an increase in deaths. And when the Congress imposed a national speed limit in response to the energy crisis, there was a 55-mile-per-hour speed limit across the country, death rates declined. So there is a clear link.
I think that there are some people who have this idea, particularly when you're talking about rural interstates, where the volume of traffic may be less, that higher rates of speed aren't that much of an issue. And I can imagine places, particularly out in the West, where you might be driving along and conceivably you could drive for a long period of time and not even see another car, or there are not going to be a lot of cars. And I would think that that would mean that the speed wouldn't be an issue, but perhaps it still is.
Well, one of the things that people often forget or don't realize is that about half of the fatal crashes that occur don't involve another vehicle. They are single-vehicle crashes. And multi-vehicle and single-vehicle crashes are both affected and are and increase when speeds increase. So it is true that you can be on these rural interstates and not be involved with another vehicle, but your risk of having a single vehicle crash also increases with higher speeds.
Okay. We have some other folks to talk with, and I think we have someone who is calling from a car phone. Let's go there, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Okay. I think the speed limit nationwide kind of dropped in 73, if I remember right, down to 55. Is that correct, or do you know?
It was in the mid-70s. I'd have to look at that. That may be about that.
I was thinking about 73.
Right after the energy crisis.
I think it was 1974.
Was it? Okay. Do you have facts on the number of deaths in the previous year as compared to the deaths the year that they dropped it to 55? I was curious about that. And then number two, you were saying a while ago, in some rough road out here, that the third of all the fatalities last year or 2002, I don't remember which, involved speed. Out of those, do you have any facts on those fatalities, whether those cars were high horsepower cars or average or low horsepower cars?
Well, on the second question first, I mean, in terms of the horsepower's effect on crashes, one of the things that some of the data that we collect involves the insurance claims. In addition to the fatal crashes, the insurance claims on vehicles by make and model. And the general pattern that you see is that vehicles with high performance image or high performance engines or both tend to have higher rates of crashes.
You don't have any facts though on that, do you?
We have a publication on our website, which is highwaysafety.org, which lists the collision claim rates for vehicles by make and model. And what you'll see there is that vehicles, high performance vehicles, have higher claims rates. So they are involved in crashes at a higher rate than regular vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Of course, now here's another thing, too. the higher horsepower vehicle generally is bought by a younger public. And the younger public has less schooling in driving. So therefore, they might have crashed the same car with lesser horsepower motor, is what I'm trying to get at here.
Well, you also see, though, that some of the high-performance vehicles that are not accessible by young people, the Porsches, the Corvettes, those types of expensive high-performance vehicles also have very high rates of crashes, fatal or property damage. So it's not just a matter of the driver.
Okay, you're talking about in the new car category. I'd be curious to know, too, Greens, you brought that up, is the older person, say, 45, 55 years old, that buys an old Corvette with a high horsepower motor. Do you have any facts on that or anything? I mean, that's getting kind of particular,
Yeah, our data looks at vehicles that are generally 1 to 3 years old, so we don't get into the older vehicles.
Okay. And then, do you go back as far enough to answer my first question there about the when they dropped the speed limit?
Well, when they dropped the speed limit, death rates did go down.
But you don't know the facts on either one, either year, though, right?
We have a number of studies that looked at the effect of the drop of the speed limit, and I can send those to you separately. But it's clear that the death rates went down when the double nickel went into effect.
Okay.
And that they gradually went up as
how much or anything like that?
I'm sorry?
Percentage wise, you know about how much it went down that 1 year? See, we're talking basically the same group of people in the same era driving basically the same cars. I'm just curious about how much it dropped by dropping the speed limit. Basically, 15-mile-an-hour drop. Most states had 70-mile zone at that time. And it went from there down to 55, and I was just curious what percentage-wise, how much it dropped or how many people.
Let me tell you the studies that I have in my fingertips here.
Okay.
The deaths on interstates increased between 25% and 30% when states increased their speed limits from 55 to 65 in 1987. And that was about the time that Congress abolished the national speed limit.
And they increased how much?
They increased 20% to 30%. Study done in 1989 showed that about two-thirds of the increase, or about 19%, was attributed to the increase in speed. In other words, they adjusted for the fact that people are traveling more, so there's more exposure to people getting in crashes. And adjusting for that, they showed that the deaths, there was an excess number of deaths, about 400 extra deaths that could be attributed to the speed limit increase that would not be associated simply from higher travel. We did a study in 1999 that looked at the effects of states that increased their speed limits starting in about 1995. And we looked at 24 states that raised their speed limits during 1995 and 1996. And we compared the fatality counts in the 6 years before the speed limits were changed. And what we found is that there was about a 15% increase in deaths on the interstates in those states that raise their speed limits.
Okay, now here's another thing, too. When you increase somebody's speed from 55 to, say, 65 or 70, some of those people, they don't have time to adjust before they have a problem. If you decrease it from in 1973 from 70 down to 55 and 74, say, it's not hard to adjust to that. So, and then number two, why would you only compare 24 states? Why would you compare all 48? I mean, all 50.
Well, we looked at the important thing in doing a study like that is to take the states where you had an increase in speed limits. And so we picked 24 that had an increase. And then you need to compare those with states that didn't change their speed limits at all. And so we took 7 states that didn't change their speed limits during that time, so that you have a comparison to look at what the whether the death rates actually increased due to the speed limits or some other reason.
Okay, just one last question. I don't think it'll take up all your time here, but how many drivers are on the road today as compared to 1960? you know?
Well, there are many, many more drivers on the road, and they're driving more miles.
Do you have any idea?
I'm sorry?
Numbers? Do you have any numbers?
I don't have a number for you on how that's increased since 1960.
Okay. All right.
One thing that you see in the statistics on deaths on our highways is that that the number of deaths each year has stayed pretty steady for the last 5 to 10 years. It hovers around 40 to 42,000 deaths each year in automobile crashes.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Russ Rader. He's the Media Relations Director for the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. This is an independent nonprofit highway safety research group that is funded by the auto insurance industry. They do research on a wide range of issues, including vehicles and driver behavior. They also do crash testing on new vehicles. And we're talking here generally about automotive safety, both things that apply to the vehicle itself and its qualities, and also to the people who drive them, and how all of those things can either contribute to safety or lack of safety. And if you have questions, you can call 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Our next caller is in Danville on line 2. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Kind of ironic that we're talking about highway safety and we have someone driving and talking on a cell phone. I've got a couple of three questions here. You've made some statements, Russ, of, you know, that it's more dangerous, it's a big safety issue, and yet I thought this last year in 04, or it might have been 03, I'm not sure, that we had the lowest number of fatalities in the last 30 years. Is that correct?
We do have the lowest fatality rate ever on record currently.
Okay. If you look at forever, then, which actually kind of supports, I guess, my argument here a little bit more, if you look at the number of drivers and the amount of miles that they travel, you're looking at a factor that is truly phenomenal in the amount of safety that one has getting in a car and traveling down the road. Is that not correct?
Well, driving is probably the riskiest thing that you will do in any given day.
Based against any other kind of transportation, true.
Based against other kinds of transportation and based against other things that we do during the day. The thing about highway fatalities is that the rate has come down dramatically, and that's a combination of a lot of different things. More people are wearing seatbelts. Vehicles are much more crash-worthy today than they were 20 years ago. We have airbags now that we didn't have 20 years ago. So the fatality rate has come down dramatically, but what do we do about these 42,000 deaths that we have every year on our highways? I mean, that's a number that's difficult to ignore. Yes, safety has improved on our roadways, but there's a lot more that we can do to make our roadways even safer. And while speed is only one factor in a whole range of different things that lead to deaths on the highway, it is an important one, and it often is overlooked.
Well, correct, but at the same time, if you look at the number of drivers that are entering the driving marketplace, so to speak, each year, it actually is becoming safer and safer and safer to drive.
Question about it.
Also, you had mentioned something about a 15% increase in the states that had raised their driving speed from 55 up. If you look at that 15%, how much of that was due to the amount of increase in the number of drivers?
That was taken into account in that study, so that was adjusted for in the study.
Okay. All right. Great. Well, those are my questions. Thanks.
All right. Thanks for the call. Well, just let me ask you, Mr. Rader, because we're here, one of the kind of numbers that we're using as an indication of highway safety is fatalities.
Uh-huh.
It is also, again, perhaps because cars are more crash-worthy, we have people wearing seat belts, we have cars that have airbags. It is now certainly possible for a person to have an accident and total their car and walk away.
Right.
Is it possible to talk about the number of accidents, say accidents in which cars are totaled aside from whatever injuries the people might experience?
Well, I mean, the problem with speed is that regardless of the improvements that we've made in vehicles, and regardless of the fact that more people are wearing seatbelts, we do crash tests of vehicles, for example, at 40 miles per hour. If you crash at a very high speed, you overwhelm all of the safety factors that I just mentioned, the airbags, the fact that you may be wearing a seatbelt, the fact that the vehicle is built much better than it would be if you were driving 20 years ago. That's one of the issues with speed, is that it increases the likelihood of a crash, reduces your car's ability and your restraint system's ability to protect you in that crash.
Let's talk with someone else in Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, somebody did, and I had the same reaction. Factoring in, I'll just raise two and then let you comment on them. The cell phone, in terms of certainly people talking on the cell phone, you know, the increased likelihood. Has there been anything that's been studied there? Also, the SUV, when we also had, you know, this trend toward more efficiency and, you know, the smaller cars, more efficiency. The SUV certainly is thrown in a factor there, too. So, anyway, I'll let you comment on those two.
All right.
Well, in terms of cell phones, we don't, the jury is not in on whether cell phones are a big safety problem or not. Clearly, they are a distraction, but we need more research to know exactly what kind of effect those are cell phone use is having on crash rates. That's something that just hasn't, it's still a murky area. In terms of SUVs and vehicle types, there are, you know, a couple things that I would just point out in that arena. Certainly SUVs have had a problem with rollover. So despite the fact that you get an advantage from the size and weight of an SUV if you're in a crash with another vehicle, that is somewhat offset by the risks associated with SUVs and rollover in a single vehicle type crash. You know, if you're looking for a safe vehicle, what we generally say is that a midsize or larger car that gets a good crash test rating is probably is generally a safer bet than a small car, which doesn't offer as much protection as a bigger vehicle, or an SUV. So in terms of the effect on the fatalities by the different vehicle mix out on the road, that certainly has been a factor.
All right. Again, I want to thank the caller and welcome others. If you have questions, we have about 20 minutes left in this part of Focus. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Again, our guest, Russ Rader, is Media Relations Director for the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. It's an organization that is funded by the auto insurers, and they do research on things like auto safety. They do some crash testing. They also look at issues of driver behavior, and questions are welcome. It does, I'm glad the caller got to the issue of the cell phone, just because it seems that nowadays there are increasing number of driver distractions in the vehicle available to people. We have now onboard navigation systems that are supposed to help you not to get lost or know where you're going. There are a lot of cars now that offer DVD players in them, although I think that they're supposed to be there for the passengers and not for the driver. And we do also have the issue, and I know that I'm sure it's on a lot of people's minds, that is the issue of people talking on the telephone when they're driving. There may be some other things, too. Are you particularly concerned about, generally speaking, about the issue of driver distractions?
Yes, that's going to be a major area of study in the coming years. We know that there are a lot of distractions in the vehicle. It's something that that needs to be examined closely. As I said, with cell phones, it's still sort of a murky area where we don't know. It's difficult to weigh the relative risks of different kinds of distractions. Is talking on the cell phone more risky than fiddling with the CD player or talking to a passenger? Those are the things that we don't know for sure yet, but the evidence seems to be pointing toward a risk, both from the act of dialing a cell phone, to talking on the cell phone, whether it's a handheld or a hands-free device. But certainly there's a proliferation of distractions in the vehicle, and that's going to be a subject of a lot of study in the future. Mm-hmm.
We just got a number of other callers, and so we'll try to get right back to phones here for a moment. But just real quick, one question that I wanted to ask. Earlier, I asked this question when we were talking about speed limits, about driving in rural areas where there's perhaps not a lot of traffic, and maybe you wouldn't encounter a lot of other cars, and for that reason, some people might argue that higher speed limits are not problematic. And you pointed out that, in fact, well, if you look at the accidents that occur on roads like that, a lot of them are single vehicle accidents. It's not a matter of one car hitting another. And I was curious, what are the most common causes of single vehicle accidents? Or is there a sort of a top 10 list or a top 5 or something like that of reasons for that?
Well, there are always there's not always one factor in a crash, but there can be multiple ones, although there often are multiple ones. Speed is a factor in single vehicle crashes. Driving at night is a factor in single vehicle crashes. Driving while impaired by alcohol is a factor in single vehicle crashes. Half the fatalities in crashes on the highways involve just one vehicle. So there are multiple factors. Certainly, as we've been discussing, speed, that is an issue, because when you're in a crash, whether it's a crash with another vehicle or you run off the road in a single vehicle crash and roll over or hit something on the side of the road, speed makes that crash more severe.
All right, let's talk with some other folks who are listening. Next is Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I just wanted to quickly touch on the SUVs and safety, or at least have you touch on it. I read somewhere that accidents involving SUVs, while the people inside the SUV were safer, that the people in the other vehicle that were hit by the SUV or involved in the accident with the SUV were much more likely to experience severe bodily injury or fatality.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just go and let you talk. Thanks.
Yeah, that's an issue we've been looking at very closely, because there is this new vehicle mix out on the road. You know, in the past, 20 years ago, SUVs were work vehicles. Now they're the vehicles that soccer moms are driving. And when they are in collisions with smaller, lighter vehicles, the smaller, lighter vehicle usually loses. We have been working with the manufacturers to come up with some ideas for making this less of an issue. One of the things that the manufacturers have agreed to do is to lower the energy-absorbing structures in the front of SUVs to make them more compatible with cars. And that's something that's going to be that you'll be seeing more and more of in the coming years. Of course, we're seeing more SUVs that are lower to the ground because we're seeing more car-based SUV models. But you also see the SUVs that the traditional type, work type, four-wheel drive SUVs, like the Ford Explorer, those types of vehicles with a lot of ground clearance, where the manufacturers are adding structures to the front end of those vehicles to make them more compatible with vehicles that they run into. And the manufacturers have pledged to make those changes over the next few years, with the goal of reducing that incompatibility that we see with a lot of SUVs on the road and pickups on the road, too. And those vehicles are inevitably in collisions with lower-riding cars.
Well, just to make sure that people understand what it is you're saying and that I understand, what you're talking about is when it comes to the trucks and the SUVs, doing something to the front ends essentially of them so that they'll smush more. I guess that's the way I think about it, that they will actually sustain more damage because they will crumple, I guess, and absorb some of the force rather than all of the force of the collision going into the other car.
It's more of an issue of making sure that the crash-absorbing structures that are built into vehicles line up. In other words, you think about if you take two paperback books and line them up and smack them into each other, that is a better situation if they are lined up properly than if you have one book raised up higher than the other one and you collide them into each other. One book is going to ride up over the other one. And that becomes a serious problem in a crash between two vehicles where the structures don't line up. And so this is what the manufacturers have pledged to do, to make those paperback books line up so that they collide with each other and absorb the impact of the collision so that one vehicle doesn't override the other one.
Okay. All right. Well, let's go next. We have, again, somebody calling from a car. Line two. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. I have a question about driving technique. Is it safer to drive the speed limit when everybody else is driving 10 miles over, or is it safer to go with the traffic flow? Thank you.
I think it's a good question because
question.
If everybody's going really fast and you decide you're going to go the limit, you actually can be a hazard.
Well, you know, this is a tough one. It certainly is safer to be going the speed limit than to be going over the speed limit. If you find yourself in a situation where vehicles are going at, you know, dramatically different speeds, you almost have no choice but to keep up with the traffic flow. But this is the problem that we're seeing on highways around the country, is that when the speed limit is set at a certain point, drivers are going to go as fast as they think they can go without getting a ticket. And the problem is really a law enforcement problem, is that unless we can enforce the speed limits, people are going to far exceed the speed limits. And so you're going to see more of the kind of situation you just described. But it is safer to be going the speed limit than it is to be going faster than the speed limit.
Okay, let's talk next with someone in Potomac, I think, line three. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Well, I'm glad to get a chance to talk to you. I just want to make a comment, and then I had a question. The comment is that I've traveled quite a bit on the highways, interstates, by traveling between Texas and Chicago and all over this area. And I found that you can puddle along on the interstate at whatever speed you think you'd like to go. And then when you get close to a city like St. Louis or Chicago, and everybody suddenly is going 10 to 20 miles faster than they are out on the open road. And here you are traveling along, you know, at two car lengths away from somebody, and you're going 85, 90 miles an hour. And the truck's mixed in, and it's all very exciting. But my question was, I don't have a good grasp on what a 400-horsepower engine would be useful for, as far as I drive a 1990 Honda Civic, and I don't know what the horsepower is on that four-cylinder engine. But can you equate the horsepower say what sort of work it can do? Like, is a big truck have thousands of horsepower, or does a Hummer have 200 horsepower? Could you just go ahead and equate horsepower to sort of relative sizes of vehicles that we encounter on the street?
Well, I guess I don't exactly know the answer to that. I think typically a standard family sedan might have something like, 150 horsepower. And I'm just sort of guessing that, thinking about things like a Ford Taurus or a Toyota Camry. And these vehicles are perfectly capable of accelerating, merging onto the freeway, passing another vehicle. That's plenty of horsepower to do what you need to do in normal driving.
Sure.
I can't imagine what anyone would need 400 horsepower for in normal driving.
Right, and that's what I was thinking. Maybe a larger pickup, a one-ton pickup or something, that you'd be pulling, loads of horse trailers or boats or whatever would have.
Yeah, and certainly you need horsepower to do things like, towing trailers and doing things with vehicles that you're using for recreation or for work and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But what is so puzzling or so amazing is the fact that these 400 horsepower engines are being put in family sedans. I mean, you see it with the Chrysler products and the Hemi engines that are going into what would normally be your standard family sedan.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you.
All right, thanks. Next, go to another cell phone person here, line number one. Hello.
Hi, I just wanted to ask a question. I had a friend when I was young, and he was he drank a lot, and he was also very depressed. And one day he took his Harley Davidson, and he drove it right up the back of a truck, and he was killed. And as an adult, I've known of at least one individual who was very depressed over a broken family relationship, and they put her in the hospital because they didn't want her driving a car. So I'm wondering, have they been able to actually collect data on, what would you call it, suicide by automobile? Because, it seems to me that would be very relevant, particularly when we talk about suicide by alcoholism.
It's a good question. We have not done a study like that, so I'm not aware of anything like that.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. It seems to me that would be very difficult to determine what the state of mind of the individual was,
right.
I think, as the caller says, I think it would be an interesting question, but I think it would be a really tough one to answer. Well, let's go on to next caller, and that's Champagne in line two. Hello.
Hi. I don't know if you've discussed teenage drivers yet on this show because I'm tuning in a little late.
We haven't. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I have two teenagers who are 15 and have learner's permits. They're twins. And I'm feeling like in the state of Illinois, and even though they've had private driving lessons, that they're terrible drivers. And I have the role of taking them out for 20 hours apiece. And I'm a terrible driving teacher. And the clock is ticking until they turn 16 and get the full-size license. So I came from California where we got simulators and trailers at school. And I just feel like driving instruction has kind of gone down, and so much is put on the parent. And when you have a parent like me, it's very daunting. So that's question number one. Question number two is, I also will need to buy a car, and probably a used car. And is there any kind of place to look for the safest vehicle in a used car? Because sort of the conventional wisdom was that the bigger the clunker, the less harm they can cause, or experience. But I think newer cars are safer, but I don't want them to have a big car. I want them to have a small car. So any comments on that, and I'll hang up. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, let me take the relatively easy question first, the second one. There is a place that you can go to look for vehicles that have good crash test ratings. The Insurance Institute conducts crash tests, and we have been doing frontal crash tests since 1995, which is the most common type of real-world crash. So you can see ratings for vehicles going back to 1995 on our website, which is highwaysafety.org. And the vehicle ratings are there. There's a tab there. You can click on them and do research on various types of vehicles. I would caution you against putting your beginning driver in a small car. Small cars, whether they are new or older, do not offer as much crash protection as a bigger vehicle. What we tell parents is that it's better to have your teen in a midsize or larger car than to have them in a small car or to have them in an SUV, which small cars don't offer the crash protection of bigger vehicles. SUVs have handling problems, which are not good for beginning drivers. So I would look for a midsize or larger car that has a good crash test rating, and there are many of them that do, and that you can find on the used car market. Vehicles like the Ford Taurus, the Toyota Camry, those are vehicles that have been getting good crash test scores for a number of years. You want a vehicle that has the modern features like airbags. So check out the ratings on highwaysafety.org. On the first part of your question about teen drivers, believe it or not, you're the best teacher. You may not have as much confidence in yourself as your abilities might indicate, but parents are the best teachers. And Driver Ed has been a bust as far as making teens safer drivers. The evidence shows that Driver Ed may in fact make things less safe out on the roads, because what it does in some states is allow teens to be licensed earlier. The best thing that you can do as a parent is spend a lot of time in the vehicle with your teen driving, supervising them and teaching them. And that goes a lot farther than any driver ed program.
Let's try to real quick get one more. Southern LaSalle County, line number 4. I'll have to ask you to be brief, though, but please go ahead.
Fine, thank you. As far as your experience, do you have anything to say about hand-controlled driving, and only hand control? And also, as far as being someone that is disabled, I know there are all kinds of crashes, but is there something where you, should you sit in the passenger side or should you sit in the back? Thank you.
Well, we don't have any studies on those types of hand controls for people with disabilities. But you know, if everyone was going to sit in the safest place in the vehicle, it would be in the back seat. But somebody has to drive. So the best thing you can do is to get a vehicle that has a good crash test rating, and that's the start for having a safe vehicle.
Well, we're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. Again, for people who are interested in looking at some more information that has to do with auto safety, you can look at the website that we have mentioned. It's www.highwaysafety.org. That's the website of the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. Our guest, Russ Rader, he's the Media Relations Director for the Institute. It's a nonprofit, independent research group that is funded by auto insurers, and there are a lot of interesting information there about auto safety, and so you might take a look at it. And we want to say, Mr. Rader, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to do it anytime.
Very good. Programming here on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. Programs are also made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Coming up a little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, that's the program that gets underway at noon, we'll be talking about the politics of poverty. Bill Clinton's speechwriters came up with a slogan back in 1991 that one pollster called pure heroin. That slogan was, end welfare as we know it. Today at 1 o'clock, New York Times reporter Jason DeParle will be talking with Celeste Quinn. She's the host for the show. He tracked one family's struggle to make ends meet without welfare and tells the story in the book American Dream, Three Women, Ten Kids, and a Nation's Drive to End Welfare. That's in the 1 o'clock hour. The show itself gets underway at noon. Celeste Quinn is the host. In the next hour of this show, we'll be talking about cotton and its importance in American history with Stephen Yaffa, who's written a new book on that. First, though, we'll take a break for news and update on the markets. Stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-